So we've come more or less to the halfway point in the retreat, possibly a little bit more, not quite sure, but virtually halfway. And just sort of wondering how it's all going. Might be a good time to just have a chat about it. For me, one of the great, one of the most interesting aspects of leading retreats is when I conduct these reviews or interviews with people and sort of get their feedback and get a sense of what's going on with them, and just to see all the different things that are going on is from my point of view is wonderfully interesting, because you just get the whole spectrum of anything between heaven and hell, basically. And how all of us, really, we all, I think most of us, if we stick at this long enough, do experience both heaven and hell, and all the realms in between. That's why I say the human birth, the human condition, is said to be the one, the only one, where we actually do get a taste of all the realms of samsara. And coming on retreat, it's fascinating to see how all these realms are on display over the days. And you know, for all of us, sometimes we can have a bit of a giggle about these things, but other times, of course, it's very serious, and all sorts of things are going on which we certainly couldn't laugh about. But this is all part and parcel of what we do. You know, sometimes it's just joy and light and bliss, happiness, all the things that we would like to aspire to, all the things that we read about, all the experiences of what they must be experiencing in the higher heavens, and how we can get a taste of those experiences, and just think it's really fantastic. And out of those sorts of experiences, insight can come as well, as well as just the physical joy, mental joy, emotional joy, but actually insight as well. So, you know, the fruit that can show itself in retreats is really quite wonderful. And I think if we all stick at it long enough, we'll certainly get tastes of that, if not, you know, a fair bit. Hopefully not too much, because especially the joyful bits and the blissful bits, is that we can so easily get seduced by those experiences, and we want them more and more, and we forget actually why we're here, what we're doing, and we're here really to learn about ourselves and go through the transforming process. And the transforming process actually doesn't take place in heaven, unfortunately. If it were, then I think there'd be even more people here on retreat. That's much more the fruit of practice, of what comes out, and also the way that we move quite naturally between all the realms of you know, from the light to the dark, which characterizes our experience of life. And as I say, we can get the light and the joy and the insight, but of course we can also experience the other side, which is something that we need to focus on more rather than focus on the light, because we don't really need to be encouraged about the light. We all enjoy it. We all know that it's great, and none of us want to leave it. So we don't really need to sort of dwell on that side of things, but rejoice when it comes along and enjoy, certainly enjoy what it's there. What we need to focus on is the more difficult aspects of our experience on retreat, which is the good old dukkha that we get to come face to face with, even more pronounced than in our daily lives, because we're creating an environment where we're not allowing ourselves to dissipate ourselves and to avoid the unpleasant things of life, unpleasant things about ourselves. We're closing all the doors down, shutting everything down, not allowing ourselves to escape, but putting ourselves in a position, a situation where we we have to sit with ourselves. Maybe this is the only time when we really sit with ourselves, and when we sit with ourselves, we get to see lots of stuff which is not always very pleasant. But this is the nature of retreats, and that's what they're for. And this is hopefully why we come. We come expecting to get a whole raft of experiences, and not expect it to be just joy and light and fun. If that's what you want, then you definitely don't come to places like this, because change doesn't take place in the middle of fun and light and stuff. Great though that may be, it takes place in the middle of dukkha. That's just how things are. And we, all of us, experience dukkha with very few exceptions. Most of us, most of the time, are gonna, or most of us, some of the times, a lot of us. Most of the time, some of us, all of the time, experience dukkha continually on a retreat. Now, the dukkha can come in forms of just the physical dukkha of actually putting ourselves in these postures for several hours a day, days on end, which, of course, we're not used to doing. We don't do it at home. We don't do it in our daily life, but we come in, we do it for several hours, and this can evoke all sorts of physical difficulties. And then, of course, we're consumed by our thoughts. we're consumed, and we experience our emotions. And because we're in this sense of containment, we're not allowing ourselves to dissipate, because these things become very much more intense and very much more directly experienced. And this is the way, this is our experience, and it's a learning to work with these more difficult aspects of our experience is really what is very much the heart of retreats. And to realize that, and I think this is a mistake that so many of us can make, that, you know, when these, what we may consider to be distractions, physical discomfort, emotional turmoil, mental chattering, somehow they're getting in the way of my practice. I've come here to get into concentrated states. I've come here to enjoy the fruits of concentrated states, and I've come here for insight and for change. And very often become resentful towards these other experiences, which definitely will be around physical, emotional, mental stuff, that by golly we would be very happy if we never had these experiences. And somehow we can very often resent these things, and because we experienced this dukkha in these various forms, we can then start to say, well, I have another very good retreat. This isn't a good retreat. What we're doing on the retreat's not very good. And then we can start to blame the person who's leading, blame the form, the timetable, the silence, anything that you can get your head on, blame and wish that it were different. If I could change it, shift it around to make it the way that I want it, everything will be that much better. Because I've come here because I want a positive retreat. I want something really good to come out of all of this. I've come all this way, I've spent all this money, and I don't want to sit here suffering for a week. And you know, develop negativity around that, and create tensions and create all sorts of actually reinforce the dukkha that we've already got. I think this is, no one's of course suggesting that we enjoy this, because we can't, but to look on it as with a negative mind, to think, well, it shouldn't be like this, I've not come here for this, I've come here for something else, to look at it in that light, I think is very much a wrong view, and actually you're going to compound the situation for yourself, make it even worse than what it is. But actually take it as an opportunity, as a gift, as an offering for you to get to know yourself, to open up to yourself and begin to to see your limitations, to see how you want the world to be the way that you want it to be, the way that you want to manipulate it, and how you don't want this, but you rather have that. You want the light, but you don't want the dark. And to see that this is the way we are. This is the way we are as people. This is the human condition. We're in that perpetual mode of manipulating, of wanting and not wanting, and running away from the dark and trying to run after the light. And then see that is the human condition. Rather than open up, take the opportunity now. Maybe you can't do it in your normal life because we have so many distractions, but take the opportunity now to open up to the whole of your experience, to the whole of the light, which we open up to with great relish, but also to open up to the dark, to the difficult, to the dukkha, and open up and say yes to it, and actually, without being masochistic, actually welcome it, because it's giving you the opportunity to transform the karma, your habits, your conditioning that has pulled you around all of your life, this life and other lives, and will continue to pull you around, enslave you for the rest of your life, making you run this way, making you run that way, avoiding this and avoiding that, wanting this and not wanting that, running around knowing full well that whatever you do actually is never going to be fulfilled, because whatever you do, whatever you achieve, you know full well it's going to go into change, and whatever it is going to fall away from you, which makes you even more anxious, which makes you even more desperate to be running around grasping at wanting to have the light, wanting to have the good. Here we have the opportunity to break that habit, because that habit will take you on forever. It will literally take you on forever if we are not prepared to open up to it and to use and to make the opportunity, to take the opportunity to actually send that whole volition, that thing that just rolls on and on, send the whole thing into change, so then we really do experience the peace and the lightness and the joy that we all so much desire. But that peace and that joy will not be something temporary that you manage to manipulate, that you manage to sort of evoke and hold on to. Not that joy that will, as soon as it comes, will be on its way off again into the void, but a joy and a peace and a lightness that will, if we persevere and if we stay, will be permanent. It will be forever. We like to think, us Buddhists like to think that everything is impermanent, but actually there is a permanence. There is a permanence beyond impermanence. And if we can truly bear with and exhaust that impermanence, then we will taste. Then that impermanence will become permanent. And that to me is something to rejoice in and something to aspire to. And for me, it makes what life is for, is to aspire to that eternal freedom. And we have the opportunity on retreat to open up to all the difficulties that we've got, open and embrace and say yes to. And one thing that we must really learn to turn away from is our very, very deep conditioning of good and bad and right and wrong. Because you're sitting on the cushion, and because you're having physical difficulty, emotional, mental difficulty, turmoil, that you know your concentration doesn't come together. You sit there, you may sit there for hours, you may sit there for days, and you think, well, this is just a complete waste of time. I can't concentrate, I can't do what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm having a bad meditation. This is bad meditation. Good meditation is when I'm concentrated and when I'm fulfilling all the things that I imagine that I have to fulfill. This is good meditation. And when this is not happening, then boy, I'm having bad meditation. And I can sit here for days and have bad meditation. I think if you go down that road, I think not only do you miss the point, you actually miss something very, very important. But actually you're compounding your misery and you're compounding your negativity and your lack of self-esteem and all of that stuff by going down this judgmental road. And this is what we do in our lives. We spend our whole lives in a mode of being judgmental towards ourselves and towards others, and shifting and turning everything into black and white, into light and dark, into good and bad, etc. And on it goes, because it's not permanent, is it? Everything keeps shifting around, and we're forever chasing these little realms that we want to create. And this, the opportunity to actually open up to the whole of ourselves without judgment, and don't say good meditation, bad meditation, because I think that's just, that is a profound lack of understanding of how the Dharma works. It isn't about you creating some wonderful meditational state and then feel, well, I'm really practicing the Dharma because I'm now feeling like this. I think my own experience of this, and I mean, I can take this back a long way, and I realized very early on that actually that's just a deception, a delusion, and very much a Mara, this thing of good and bad. We can talk in this context of good meditation and bad meditation, which is a trap that we all fall into. And I discovered a long time ago that this is not about good meditation and bad meditation, whatever that is. I mean, after all, that is just your opinion. I think what this is about, what is really fundamental, what is the real key to change, it isn't about good meditation, it isn't about not having bad meditation. I don't think that's the key to change. I think the key to change is your commitment to come back, to come into the practice, to open up, to be as wholehearted as you can with whatever is in front of you. We can be wholehearted when everything is going well, but being wholehearted when things are not going so well is very difficult, and this to me is the real test of commitment. It's when we're willing, for example, to come to the cushion and know, absolutely guarantee, that there's not going to be 2 seconds of concentration. You're going to be all over the place mentally, you know, your body's going to start playing up, and you know, you get, and sure enough, you're right. You come to the mat, and it's just exactly how you imagine it to be. And you think, well, this is really bad meditation, this is really bad practice. That's a mistake. Bad practice is thinking, well, clearly I'm not in a state at the moment to be in a concentrated meditation, therefore I won't bother to meditate. That's bad practice. Because you are turning away from yourself, from your own practice with the stuff that all the things that we need to work with. You decide that you can't face up to the fact that you're not going to put 2 seconds of meditation, 2 seconds of concentration together. So you decide to exit, you decide not to do. That's bad practice. I believe, and this became clear to me many years ago, that when I really determined to throw myself into this practice the best I could, and that's something very, it's not verbal, you can do it verbal if you wish, but it's something that is very much an inner commitment with you, and very much in your heart, in the very centre of your being, that you are going to apply yourself to this practice as wholeheartedly as possible in all circumstances. And I believe that if that commitment is genuine, I'm sure there must be Sanskrit words and Pali words for this, I don't know, but I'm sure there must be, that if that commitment is genuine, and only you know if it's genuine, you can play games out here, but you know in your inner self, in your heart, if it's genuine or not. If that commitment is genuine and you stay with that commitment, to me, that's where change begins to take place. It's that commitment that begins to break up that samsaric world, that the darkness and all of that, that knot of karma and of samsara that grips us in our body. I think a message gets sent, if it's genuine, if it's sincere, gets sent right into the heart of that and says that the game is up. And from now on, I'm going to apply myself with a consistency to working with whatever from now on, well, just from now on, without any projections that there is some sort of an end date involved. And it's that commitment is where change instigates change. So then if you see it in those terms, you no longer see things as good and bad. You don't see good practice and bad practice. That type of judgment. And it's a waste of time. And I know for me, you know, that helped me. I mean, I've always been blessed with, from the very beginning, I've always been blessed with the most wonderful meditation, almost consistently from the beginning. I've never needed, personally, you know, a lot of inspiration from other people and things. It's the inspiration has always been with me, and I'm deeply grateful for that. But I did have a period about 20 years ago, I think, in the mid-80s, where I went 1.5 years, 18 months, living in England, 1.5 years, when I just... I couldn't put 3 seconds together. I'd sit down and I'd go back to my basic practice that I learned right at the beginning, which was counting my breath, 1, 2, on the out breath. And if I ever got to number 3, then that was just awesome. It just never happened. And I knew, and this wasn't a few days, this was months, this was a year and a half, and I knew every time I went there that this is going to happen. And I thought, what an absolute incredible waste of time. Why don't I do something constructive, like go and watch Coronation Street or something? Far more constructive, far more meaningful than sitting on this mat, not being able to get past number 2 or number 3. But I knew that this was not the point. You see, if I sit there and I've got some desire, some projection that I should be like this and I want that, then I'm going to set up all sorts of difficulties for myself. I'm going to be disappointed. My self-esteem will just go through the floor. I may lose heart in Buddhism, in the practice, in everything, because it's not the way that I want it to be or the way that I think it should be, with these projections all the time. Unfortunately, I didn't go down that road, because I saw that Mara a long time earlier, and I just used to come day after day after day. What an absolute waste of time. Never mind. I'm committed to sitting every day, to sitting at this time, and this is what I'm going to do, irrespective of whatever may come out, or however much I like it or dislike it, however concentrated, or never mind any of those experiences. I'm just going to come to the cushion. And I had 1.5 years, and then one day it just left me. And to this day, I don't know why. There were no pictures, there was no sort of, you know, big insight that came up and told me why it was like that. I just knew that everything was impermanent, and I knew that the state of mind, the way the mind is that everything ebbs and flows. And the whole secret of practice, the whole secret of a commitment to the practice is to embrace all of it and say yes, yes. Because I knew that lack of concentration, that inability to meditate at all alone wasn't my teacher's fault, wasn't Buddhism's fault, wasn't the practice I was doing, there wasn't that fault either. It was nobody's fault. It's just the way we are, the way that we're constructed, and everything ebbs and flows. Sometimes it's like this, sometimes it's like that. And in terms of practice, it is to learn that commitment, learn that ability to step over all of those obstacles, all of those difficulties, all of those things that are trying to pull you this way, trying to pull you that way, which they do, and very often they succeed, is to learn not to be pulled around by those things, and learn to rather than label good, bad, right, wrong, etc., learn to open and just say yes. Say yes, this is the way I am, and that's fine. That's not good, that's not bad, that's the way it is, and I'm prepared to open and accept and to carry on and deal with whatever's in front of me. And I believe it's that commitment. It is not in terms of change, it is not specific things here and there. I think it's our willingness to come back, and not be pulled away by stuff that we don't like, and give up and take a you know take a holiday that may last for months and years, or change your practice, change this, change that, shifting around. But learn to see that this is what we're doing. When we come to this practice, when we come to practicing the Dharma, we are saying yes to the whole of ourselves. We are not saying yes to the bits that we like and no to the bits that we don't like. If you do that, I don't know what you'll get from it. You may get a little bit of happiness, a little bit of something or other, but it will be so superficial, and it will be nothing like the true fruit that is offered to those that practice in a wholehearted way. If we can grow into that, grow into the commitment, not into wanting the thing to be the way or the way that you think the thing should be, rather than learn to open and to embrace, so that when you get the physical pain, learn to open up to it, learn to accept it. And when you get the emotional upheavals with all the pictures and all the thoughts and all the history that can come up of your past and your upbringing and relationships, all of that stuff, oh God, I'm having a terrible meditation, I'm having a terrible... You're not having a terrible... This is how it is. You're seeing the reality of what practice is. You're seeing the whole of yourself, bit by bit, it's coming up and sitting in front of you, and it's our commitment to open and to embrace all of that without becoming reactive, without pushing and running and all the other things that we do. And it's when we do that, through that commitment to come back, and it's not easy to come back and to come back, it's that commitment that then that whole samsaric mass, that samsaric mess, that karmic stuff that we're just enslaved to, begins to shift, begins to go into change. We all want the change. Well, if you want the change, then you have to be prepared to open up to yourself and to learn to bear with yourself and to learn to like yourself. If you're not prepared to do that, then this is not the thing for you. Find something else that fits your imagination, that fits your fantasies. The Dharma is not of that order. The Dharma is about learning to embrace the whole of yourself in all situations. And we have the perfect example here in the retreat, where we're in an environment where there's no escape unless you decide to leave the retreat. But if you are prepared to stick to the timetable, prepared to with that spirit, to engage with the retreat and help the retreat to make the form that helps to support all of us. All of us needs to help to create that form, and then we can learn to partake of that form. If you're prepared to do that, so you'll come to your mat when you know, I'd rather be in bed, because being in bed's quite a nice thing, isn't it? I can sleep, I can forget myself, I can rest my weary body. I can avoid myself by stopping in bed or going for a walk and not coming to the meditation. You can do those things. No one's going to chase after you. But you're missing the point if you do that. That's not why you're here. If you think you're just going to come here until you get some sort of a bliss, and then you think, great, you know, I'm having a great retreat, that's what I come here for. Well, that may happen. Most times it won't happen. It may, and if it does, it will only come and go. And when it goes, you probably end up feeling worse than before you had it, because you want it back again. And so you start to find ways of clawing it back. Make total use to just to sit. I mean, think about it. A few days, you know, if you want to put it sort of in context with the rest of your life, if we all live to be 80 years old, you know, what's a few days in 80 years of just really disciplining yourself and putting yourself in that position where you're really opening up and really beginning to get to see yourself and beginning to see how you're put together and to see how we're in this eternal mode of always manipulating and fiddling and just trying to control and avoid and see the dukkha that's involved there. See the dukkha that's in that unsatisfactoriness that's always with us, always hopping around, wanting something, trying to avoid something. And then when we hop from it to whatever it is, that, sure enough, that goes into change, and then we're hopping somewhere else, and then we want to get it back. And I mean, that's called dukkha. That's like an agitation on a subconscious level. Actually, you can see dukkha in that regard, actually, is that it's something that's vibrating like this all the time, and we're having that perpetual state of agitation, and that's dukkha. And you know, we have this all of our lives. We got a real opportunity to send that into change by learning to bear with it, by learning not to give into it, by just, even if only for these few days, say no, I'm not going to scratch my nose as I always do. I'm not going to change my posture in the middle of, not necessarily because I'm in such terrible pain, but because it feels a bit uncomfortable, and I feel a bit restless, and I feel a bit bored, so I'll just do this. Or despite somebody giving up a great deal of their retreat, by, you know, the lads up there and myself also, actually I'm prepared to keep the time. So that means that I have to look and be as accurate as I can, the same as the other boys have had to do. So instead of just letting go as everybody else does or can, or that's the opportunity, we've always got that somewhere that, you know, we mustn't overstep and throw the whole thing out of kilter. Despite that, despite the fact that somebody is prepared to sacrifice that extra little bit like that, there are still people who look at their watch, who put their watch down in front of them and keep checking the time to make sure, what's that about? Is that really necessary? To me, that's a real sign of restlessness. That's a real sign of not wanting to sit with yourself. And I think that, you know, it's a small thing and we can laugh. But actually, when you look at it, there's a lot in that. There's a lot in there, that desire to keep checking your watch. There's a lot in there when you want to scratch yourself. You know, if we sit still, we feel little things going on all over ourselves. You know, we don't go chasing after them all the time. If we leave them alone, actually, 99.9%, unless a spider's crawled down your neck or something, the itches that we get, if we just bear with them and stay with them, actually go away. That's their nature. They come and go. And yet, when we get an itch, and you can hear, it's dead quiet, so quiet, you could hear. It's so quiet, and then suddenly you can hear. Somebody's scratching themselves somewhere. Well, to me, that's restlessness. That's not being prepared to just stay with your experience. You're giving into it. You're giving into the thing that we give in to continually in our lives that keep us trapped in this coming to be and ceasing to be. Learn to bear with it. Learn to say no. And you want to go like, no. See what that feels like. Because you don't need to know the time, because somebody else is doing it for you. So that's just nonsense, isn't it? You know that for what you have to do this at home, but you don't have to do it here, and yet you want to do it. So you go, see what that feels like. These seem like very small, insignificant things, but they're not, actually. They're very, very important things, and they're pointing to something that we need to become aware of more and more, that we need to open up to more and more. This constant agitation that we find ourselves in, this restlessness, where we just cannot be. We just cannot be in this moment. We just cannot settle with what is in front of us. We cannot do it. And when we do, and we stay with that, and we train ourselves to stay with that, there's an emotional sort of a restlessness that begins to come, that, oh, I must do something, I must move, I must do this, I must do that. Learn to stay with that. Don't give in to it, because it will pull you around forever. Learn not to give in to it. With awareness, when your awareness is present, you can catch yourself in that moment that you want to scratch, in that moment you want to look at your watch. With awareness, no, bear with it. Bear with that restlessness. Bear with that wanting to get away from yourself, that wanting to get away from the moment, that wanting to somehow imprint yourself on the moment. This is me looking at my watch. This is me scratching my body. Because that's what it's about. It's about reinforcing me over and over again. That's all it's about. And it doesn't matter what you do, it's a reaffirming that I exist, that David exists, that I am here, I am alive, I am going to scratch myself, I am going to look at my watch. That's all, it's all in one sense you think, well, that doesn't matter, that's irrelevant, that's not particularly important, not significant. But actually, there is so much insight to be got out of resisting the urge to scratch yourself. And I mean that, there's a lot of deep insight to be learned that can rise out of you bearing with your desire to scratch yourself. Now, how sort of insignificant is that? And yet, that is a common thing that we have, and something we don't even tell. Oh, well, what's that got to do with the price of fish? And then go back to your meditation or whatever. Learn to open up to that. Learn to see what is built around something so simple there. And you will learn so much about yourself. You'll learn so much about how you're put together and how you are just pulled around this way and that way. And you will see that resisting that itch that you've got there, that somehow you've got to put an end to, you see that itch as being the Buddha. That's the Buddha. And the Buddha is expressing himself, is showing himself to you, offering you the opportunity to develop insight into how you are. Something so simple, something so mundane as that is an opportunity. And we can take that opportunity in this environment, along with all the other little niggles, all the way that we want to reshape the whole the timetable, the retreat itself, and it shouldn't be like that. It should be like this. And I don't want to kneel when I'm chanting. That's something I notice. I mean, some people have got physical difficulties. That's fair enough. But other people say, I can't be bothered to kneel. Well, you know, you've been asked to kneel because that's the form. Okay, you can say at the end of the day, it doesn't matter that much. Well, okay, on one level, it doesn't matter. But you can learn so much about yourself when you have that resistance, when you say, no, I'm not going to bother to kneel, I'm going to cross my legs and I'm not going to do it that way, I'm going to do it my way, I'm not going to do it the way that I've been asked to do it. And you miss the opportunity there of actually seeing how you want to control all the time. Something quite small, something that may not be, you know, regarded as so important, and yet there is such a lesson to be learned in something so simple. There's an opportunity to learn so much about yourself, for insight, for wisdom to arise out of the fact that you do not want to kneel. And this is where liberation is. It isn't in some great grand gesture. It is in the ordinary everyday that we are participating in continually, and yet we are in this mode of always wanting to control, always wanting to manipulate, to create this self-identity, to create this barrier between me and the alien world, this separation that I feel I need to put up these barriers to protect myself. So I'm reinforcing me all the time. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I want this, I don't want that, is a way of reinforcing ourselves. That's how it works. And having the opportunity to let all of that go. Open, make yourself vulnerable. See what it feels like. Open up to it, surrender into it. We got that opportunity on the retreat. So every moment and every little thing, every gesture, every movement, every aspect of the whole day's practice, it isn't about sitting on your backside and getting into some sort of dhyanic state and thinking, well, this is a good retreat. That's a byproduct which may or may not be there. That's not what it's about. It's about learning about ourselves, and it's about taking the opportunity with everything that goes on, from when the bell goes in the morning till we fall asleep at night. Every little bit and piece that go to make up this retreat. And when you come to the cushion with all of this stuff that's going on that makes you decide that you're not having a good time, that you're not having a good retreat, learn to open up to that. Learn to say yes to it. Learn to accept that that is it. And it's not me and it's not the retreat. Actually, it's you. It's what, it's your, the world that you are building around. What is ultimately emptiness? You are building a world. You are creating a world around shunyata. So don't blame anybody else. Look at yourself and see your own limitations and take the opportunity. And don't really, you know, don't think of good and bad and right and wrong, good meditation and bad meditation. It really is, I think, it's very much a michiditti. It's a wrong view. And you're going to get stuck in that and you create so many, so make things so much more difficult for yourself when you're in this right and wrong, good and bad state of mind, state of being. Learn to embrace all of it. So when you get the physical pain, learn to open up to it and don't try to suppress it. Learn to open and say, yes, this is the way it is, and come to your meditation and learn to sit with that. And if you learn to sit with something, and this goes for everything, again, a tremendous lesson to be learned, an incredible lesson to learn in, about life and how life works. The nature of this realm that we live in is that it's full of molehills. It's always lumpy, isn't it? There's always something going on. It's just the way it is. It's never that lovely, smooth, heavenly realm that we want it to be. That's just its nature. That's the way it is. But then we come along and we experience these molehills, and then we're not prepared to leave the molehills alone. We want to grab hold of the molehills, and then we turn those molehills into mountains, and so we end up with a whole landscape of mountains and wonder why, you know, we suffer so much. Well, we're the creators. We make the mountains. There are molehills. That's the way it is. But mountains are our creation, and we make them all the time because we want things, because we identify with things, because we attach to things, and because we want things the way that I want them to be. And that thing that's a molehill becomes something huge that becomes a real problem in our life. If we could just learn to leave them alone, to live with the molehill, so that when you get a pain in your leg, see it as a molehill. It becomes a mountain when you say, oh my leg, how long have I got to sit with this? Nobody could possibly have as much pain as me. Why me? It happens all the time. Why me? And we buy into the whole experience. This is where we make mountains out of molehills. Yes, there is discomfort, maybe even pain, but we compound it many times over. Because of this self-identity, this pain is me, this pain is mine. That's what we do, and that's the mistake that we make. And then we have this judgment values on things. Learn to leave things alone. Be aware of them, open to them, accept them, do not turn away from them. But do not buy into whatever they may be. And we have that wonderful opportunity with the dukkha that we all experience in this environment, with the physical dukkha, the emotional stuff that comes up, all the pictures, the scenarios of our life, all of those things, and all the mental chattering that just never ever leaves us alone, is a golden opportunity to open up, to become alive and to become aware, to aspire to our awareness, which actually isn't involved in any of this, actually, to almost, as it were, retreat into the awareness. And open and embrace, like a mirror, embrace and know everything, but not have an opinion. And if you don't have an opinion, you won't identify, you won't make it me and mine, but rather you will leave it as it is. And if we can leave things as they are, and we do not feed them in any way, the fire, if we do not feed the fire in any way, but rather leave it alone, eventually there is only one thing that can happen. And thus it will burn itself out. And that's transformation. That's dharmic transformation. That is not a mental, intellectual shifting. That is the dharmic wisdom that transforms. And that transformation comes through a burning out, a letting out of allowing the fires to burn themselves out. And we do that by learning to open and embrace the whole of our experience and don't say this is good, this is bad. Try for the rest of the retreat to really bring that into the forefront of your minds. Think about it, meditate on it, carry it around with you. See that this isn't about having the retreat my way, and it's good and it's bad. And when I get this, it will be a good retreat. And if this happens, it's going to be a bad retreat. And I don't want this and I want that. Try to let all of that go and just open up to however it is. Have that commitment, that wholehearted commitment to bring yourself to your awareness, to bring yourself to the moment, to the situation, whatever it may be. This is your commitment, but not have any ambition to make it into something, but rather leave it alone, but have that willingness to open up to the whole of yourself and all of your experiences. And if you can do that, I think not only to me is the real heart of transformation, but you will learn so much about yourself, and you will learn to be able to take so much of that understanding back into your normal everyday lives. Because let's be honest, you know, if this practice doesn't translate, if we can't take this and integrate it into our daily life, then what on earth is it about? If it's all just some sort of a mental game that we're playing, that when we need it, lets us down. What is it worth? That's not Dharma. Dharma is something that's got its feet on the ground, that we take into our everyday life. And we can learn, we can see ourselves and learn to see how we are always putting ourselves in compartments, always wanting and not wanting. If over these few days we can let all of that go, we can awaken to that samsaric process, awaken to it and see it and learn to let it go, learn to not buy into it. So when you want to scratch, don't scratch. When you want to look at your watch, don't look at your watch and sit with the consequences. You will learn so much about yourself. So don't imagine it's about, you know, getting in a state of pure awareness or going off into some sort of jhanic state and samadhi and stuff like that. See it as a real opportunity to open up to the whole of yourself and see the whole of yourself, to see the good, the bad and the ugly. And learn to open up to that and say yes to all of it. Yes, this is the way it is, and embrace it and allow it to burn itself out. Are there any questions?
Embrace and contain. So you talk about containing love. I thought this embracing thing was containing.
Well, it is. It's just, yeah. I'm just trying to be poetic, that's all. It's, or articulate, probably, more the truth. Embracing is containing. It's to have that willingness with awareness. And that commitment, rather than react. See, it's only awareness. If you don't have awareness, you will fall into the old habit, whatever it may be, whether it's scratching your watch or the 10,000 things that we get caught up in. If you don't have awareness, you'll be like an animal that doesn't have awareness. It's just this conditioned co-production process. When something happens, something else happens, and that's... And it's that awareness that us humans have got that is the way out of suffering, is the way out of samsara. And it's that we polish. And that awareness isn't something that we create, it's something that we polish. We have it. It's there, it's all there. Everything is there. But the polishing is a learning to allow these fires to burn out. When the fires burn out, the clarity becomes that much more. The more clarity we got, the more we can open and bear with. And also what I should mention, that wasn't in your question, that actually a very important product, feature of what we do, is that when we learn to bear with things, when we learn to say bear with our physical discomfort in situations like this, learn to bear, rather than give in, learn to bear with, learn to open up and to sit with the emotional difficulty and the physical difficulty. What this does, the product that comes out of that, is that it develops inner strength. So we have the ability to bear with the difficulties of life, the challenges of life, rather than react like a baby will do, like a child would do, because children don't have inner strength. You're not born with inner strength. Inner strength is something that we cultivate in our life through discipline and through learning to restrain ourselves and not, you know, when we not get our own way, we learn to that energy, that willfulness becomes inner strength. And the more inner strength that we can cultivate, the more we can then bring to the next situation, whatever it may be. Certainly, you know, in a dharmic situation like this, in a retreat situation, that when we got inner strength, we can bear with things that bit more. And that thing that we're bearing with, once that turns over, shows its impermanence and goes into change, the energy, the life of whatever that thing is, then becomes a part of you. That's called inner strength. And this, you know, as I'm sure we all know, we need inner strength in life anyway, never mind about this situation, just dealing with the ups and downs of life and situations in life. We need that inner strength. We can't be like children bursting into tears because things aren't the way that I want them to be. We can't do that. We have to learn to bear with things. And that gives us inner strength. This is so crucial. And as this samsaric world begins to come to the fore more and more, and the very difficult experiences we can have within this practice, and the fear, especially the fear that can come out, can rise up because we're no longer keeping it down. When we practice, we're actually not exactly inviting, but we're allowing the stuff that's in our subconscious, the darkness, to rise up. And if we have that inner strength, we can bear with it. We can open to it because we have that ability. If we don't have inner strength, we will run from it. We make all the wonderful excuses in the world, but we will run from it. And when we run, especially from fear, we are actually reinforcing it. We're feeding it. We're making it even stronger. And so that fear never goes away and will be with us for the rest of our days, and it will be firmly entrenched and firm, very powerful, very strong, and have complete control over us. But with that developing inner strength, that we can begin to cultivate with the small things in life, not the big fears, but the small things, our little everyday niggles, and these little situations in this retreat situation, the little niggles, having to sit at the table while everybody gets there, when you want to just dive into the bowl of lovely food that's sitting in front of you, and you've got to sit there for 10 minutes while you fulfill what this geezer wants you to do, you know, to reflect upon there. Take that opportunity. Take that opportunity. You know, all the resentment that can come out, and why should I do this, and all this silly nonsense, sounds like I'm back in the convent again, doing all this Christian stuff. All of that stuff that can come up, there's an offering for you. That's an offering for you to change. That's an offering there to develop inner strength. And that inner strength there, in the small things, you know, it's like a little brick of a wall. The little brick. We can just about manage to work with those small bricks. The big things we can't. They're too big for us. But those little bricks, if we can work with them and stay with them until they go into change, will give you just that little bit more inner strength. Will allow you to bear with. So when the bigger things come along, you have that ability to bear with. And it is about bearing with. Dharma is about, make no mistake, Dharma is an emotional phenomenon, and it is about the transformation of emotion. And emotion is energy, is power, and it needs strength emotional strength, it needs that inner strength to be able to bear with, so that things, this is not mental, this is physical. And to have that ability to stay with and to bear with our everyday little niggles is where our inner strength becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. So when, as often can happen in this practice, when big things come along, big fears and just whatever it is that's a part of what we are, when these come up, things come up, we increasingly develop the ability to stay with it, to stay with, and that whole inner strength that then begins to increase. I think that's just, I mean, if for no other reason, it will help you get through life. Never mind any dharmic considerations. We need inner strength just to live this life. Otherwise we, by golly, we become a victim of it very quickly, and we will be nothing in this life without it.
Is this, the only analogy I can think of is raising your pain threshold. Learning, once you learn to bear a certain amount, or persevere with and overcome a certain amount of pain, when that certain amount of pain comes along again, you rise above it. Immediately you rise above it, because you've already experienced that, persevered with it, conquered it. So now you can bear that much more. Is this a...
I don't like the word conquer, because that sounds like there's something there that's entering a battle, entering a struggle, and is it entered a fight that then, you know, becomes the victor, becomes, you know, the superior in that. That's not Dharma. That's self. That's ego. Dharma isn't about entering a fight, in inverted commas. This is the difference between a worldly war, and I've always interpreted Muhammad's holy war in this particular way, though others apparently interpret it in a different way, that a holy war isn't about engaging in a battle. It very much goes along the way of the spirit of the martial arts, is that it's a way of, it's a battle of no battle, is that you engage yourself with something and let the other side burn themselves out without actually entering a physical conflict, because then you're no different than the other person, but rather a willingness to open up and let your foe, in inverted commas, do its stuff with its energy. But it can only be what it is and what it will be in the future with your engagement, with the energy that you give it, is that just perpetuates the battle of one fighting another. Whereas if you learn to open up and let the thing rant and rave, if you were, without, it's like having an argument with somebody, isn't it? You know, you want an argument with me, so you say something to me, and then I say something back to you. I react to you. I then give you the fuel then to come back to me. If you start having a rave at me and I don't react to you, and you sit and you start getting all, well, come on, what have you got to say for yourself? What are you gonna, you know, what are you gonna give back to me so that I give you back something, so then you come back to me? If I stand there and take what you say, because I don't like what you say, this is not, you know, it can be very, very hurtful, it can be very, very difficult. But if I don't feed you, if I don't come back and give you fuel, what's going to happen to you? You're going to fade away, aren't you? Because I'm not giving you fuel to come back to me again. That's the dharmic way, is that you allow it to burn itself out. That, I believe, is the holy war. That's the spiritual path. That's the spiritual war, if you like, is that you allow the enemy, in inverted commas, to burn himself out. Burn itself out, herself, whatever. Allow it to burn itself out, and have the inner strength and the awareness not to be sucked into the conflict, but open up to the conflict and just allow it to play itself out, and then eventually it will fade away. That's the dharmic way. So when you get pain in your leg, don't think that somehow you've got to master it, and this pain, that's not going to bother me, I'm stronger than it, and it's... that's just willfulness. That's just something else that we're not, that doesn't come into what we do. What we do is that we say, yes, this is there, and I accept it, and you open up to it, but you don't feed it, you leave it. And you will find, I mean, you'll find through experience that if you follow that path, however difficult it is, because it's going against everything in you, if you learn to go along that path, you will see how things change. Amazing how things change, because things just fade away. They fade away and they don't come back. They fade to the extent where they don't overpower you anymore. And when you look at it, you say, well, I haven't done anything. You just left it alone, which is what you do. And that's the dharmic way. And that we don't do in the world. The worldly way is one of reactivity, of controlling, possessing, wanting to be the master, wanting to be the... The dharmic way is unknown, virtually. Mahatma Gandhi was very good at the dharmic way. He knew how to do it. Look what that man done. He done it. Never raised a finger in his life. He's a man of pure dharma.
Is it your experience that once you have employed this acceptance, and allowed it to run out of steam, burn itself out, but that then engenders confidence.
Engenders?
Confidence. So that the next time you know...
You know the process. You know the process. That doesn't, in a sense, make it any easier. No. You've still got to go through the dukkha. But you know, you've cracked it, you've twigged it. Wow, I know what to do now. Leave it alone. That doesn't necessarily lessen... the experience, the dukkha and the pain and what have you, no. But you know, but you have faith. You know, this thing called faith that we have, which has to be blind in the beginning. You have to take other, you have to have trust in people when they tell you these things, because you don't know it as a direct experience, but you trust that what they say. You give them the benefit of the doubt, and then you put it into practice, and then lo and behold, it turns out to be true. Well, then you don't need faith anymore, because that's your direct experience. And so the next time that it comes up, you know, however, that doesn't necessarily diminish the difficulty. Don't imagine suddenly it becomes that much lighter. But you do know the dharmic way. You do know the way that if you learn to engage with it in the dharmic way, which is the engagement of no engagement, then you see that this is how change takes place. This is how this will go into change. That, as I say, that doesn't necessarily diminish your, you know, the dukkha, the difficulty of doing it, but you do know that this is the genuine way. This is the way out of suffering. Because you know that, you know, if you end up fighting something and you end up, you know, being victorious, sooner or later it's going to come back. It's going to go off and regroup and come back again. Or if that one don't come, there's going to be another one that's going to come. And you're going to be in this perpetual mode of fighting all the time. This is what we do. No wonder we get so tired out, so exhausted, because we're in a constant state of battle all the time, trying to win, trying to succeed, trying to control. Leave it alone, let it burn itself out, and you will see that, you know, once you pick that, you go beyond faith. That then becomes your own direct, and it's just so revolutionary. That you can see, well, this is the way out of suffering. You see the third noble truth. You see that this is the way, is to leave it alone. And that is massive, because that goes against everything that you've ever been brought up to believe. It goes the complete opposite way. As the Buddha said, when you take up this practice, it's like being carried by a stream that you then stop and turn around and begin to swim against the tide, begin to swim against the current. And that's what it is. It is so revolutionary. And yet when you look at it, there isn't actually anything there. This is what's so fantastic about it. When you look at it, you're not doing anything. You're learning to let the world burn itself out. That will take every ounce. This is the paradox of that, which say, oh gosh, isn't that passive? I haven't got anything to do. It will take every ounce of commitment, every sinew in your body, to be able to pull that off, to be able to pull off doing nothing. There's a very deep and very true spiritual paradox, and that characterizes the spiritual path. The spiritual path is nothing but an infinite collection of paradoxes. It is not logical, and we have to grow into the paradox, and that's done through faith, and that's done through your own direct experience, that actually it is paradoxical. Everything we do is paradoxical on this path, and this is one of the great paradoxes, that in order to transform the world we don't actually have to do anything. But it will take every ounce of commitment within you to be able to pull that off. I mean, this is the saying of Zen masters, and that's so true. We have to grow into that, and if we can grow into that, this is where change will take place. So that's all for today. Thank you.